Hello and welcome to the ERP Organizational Change Journal podcast, brought to you by Nessel & Associates. Nessel & Associates is an ERP organizational change management firm serving the private equity industry. I'm your co-host, Jonathan Donald, the founder of Invert Ventures, a change strategy firm, and I'm here with my friend and colleague, Dr. Jack Nessel, the founder of Nessel & Associates, and the host of the ERP Organizational Change Journal podcast. The ERP Organizational Change Journal seeks to share expertise, insight, and create effective conversation to help guide ERP organizational change to real, measurable, and verified success, expanding what we can see so we can act in a more effective way. We seek to promote, connect, and foster relationships in the ERP organizational change community. The primary purpose of this podcast is to discuss, share, and reflect upon effective and efficient ways in which to realize ERP organizational change success. We will discuss the people, process, and technological components of ERP organizational change. This podcast is intended as a forum to study, share, and discuss ERP organizational change. It's our intention for this to be a collaboration tool and resource. We hope that you find this podcast useful as we share lessons learned, discover best practices, and explore the human elements and components of ERP organizational change. Our podcast draws on knowledge from extensive research, collaborative learning, practitioner experience of both project successes and project failures. A general review of the themes of ERP and organizational change practice, literature, and research suggests that understanding and critically having an awareness of tactics founded in principle is fundamental to ERP organizational change success. Our podcast will discuss these tactics, explore these approaches, and discover the principles that they are founded upon so that they may prove to be useful in addressing ERP organizational change challenges and risks.
Thank you, Jonathan. I'm always so excited and looking forward to fun conversations with you and our guest. We seek to promote, connect, and foster relationships in the ERP organizational change community. As we are a podcast that desires to engage in valuable insight into the world of ERP organizational change success with interviews and roundtable talk, our guests include experts and pioneers in a field, organizational stakeholders, practitioners, and researchers. Our podcast is a platform for those seeking to share, learn, and reflect on ERP organizational change success. In this episode, Iterative Management, we will discuss the topic of our guest book with Mr. Ed Muzio. Ed is president and CEO of Group Harmonix, and his books have won awards of excellence in the performance improvement field. Ed helps executive teams make cultural shifts in a way that it effectively propagates downward into how the organization runs. His work has been hailed for producing substantial results, even in the most challenging circumstances, and Ed has been called one of the planet's clearest thinkers on management practice by the editor of an international business magazine. His mantra is higher input, lower stress, sustainable growth, a promise central to his company's mission in creating cultural changers. Originally trained as an engineer, Ed has started organizations large and small, led global initiatives in technology development and employee recruitment, and published articles and papers on a variety of business topics. Prior to founding Group Harmonix in 2004, Ed was president and executive director of a human services organization and a leader, mentor, and technologist within Intel Corporation. A Cornell University graduate, Ed's accomplishments include the creation and stewardship of a worldwide manufacturing infrastructure program, a nationally recognized engineering development organization, and a nonprofit residential program for at-risk youth. So in this episode, we will explore and discuss some key notions from Ed's book, Iterate, Run a Fast, Flexible, Focused Management Team. We will explore with Ed the idea of iterative management, what it means, how to do it, what the value this management approach brings to organizations, and much more. Please join us as we discuss what iterative management is and how you can use this approach to make your own management team operate better. Ed will share the five key practices of iterative management, And in this episode, Ed will provide insight as to how iterative management creates organizational agility and how it prevents silo issues. We will discuss Ed's model and how it is founded in sound research that can be effectively and practically applied to the workplace. Ed, thank you so much for being on our show today. I think that your work, your book, and publications are highly relevant to the field of ERP organizational change. Welcome to our podcast.
Jack, thanks for having me. And I'm always glad to be somewhere talking about helping organizations get better at change and uncertainty. And that's what you all are doing. So I'm glad to be here with you. Thank you.
Absolutely. We're looking forward to sharing your insight with our listeners for sure. All right, let's dive in, Ed. First question is, how would you define this idea of iterative management?
You know, I always use what I call sort of the most boring metaphor in the world, and that is walking to your car across a crowded parking lot. So imagine you step out of a mall or an office building, you look at your watch, you figure, I need to get to my car in a couple minutes, and then you look out over this giant parking lot in the direction where you hope your car is, and you start walking, right? What happens next is maybe the least interesting part of your day, which is in a couple minutes you get to your car and you drive. But I like to look at that as sort of a systems thing because I think there's more going on there, right? So you have this sort of CEO executive setting a pace and a direction, you know, get to your car in 2 minutes, and that's in your brain. Then you've got your workforce, your feet, and they're carrying it out. But as soon as you start taking steps, things get complicated, right? So every step you take, the surface is slippery or not, or steep or not. And you've got a lot of work going on down there in the front line of the organization, if you will, at your feet, to deal with that without any kind of escalation. Now, if they need more blood oxygen, that's a resource. They can escalate to, let's say, middle management. That's your cardiovascular system. And sometimes that system satisfies it. Sometimes that system further escalates it. Then you get that feeling of, I better breathe harder, right? At the same time, you're looking out in your CEO office into the distance and you're saying, that's not my car or there's a barricade over there. And so you're feeding information down. And so you've got this whole complex system that is sending information up, information down, and all of these decisions getting made at different levels for only one purpose, which is every step you take is the best step you can take from there, not from some plan you made and you left the building, but from there. And every step you take gets you information, and the information from that step is incorporated into the next step. That's what I mean by iterating. I mean taking the best step you can from where you are, and then making sure when you do that again in the next step, you've incorporated everything you've learned from the last step. And we need organizations doing that just like you do it when you walk to your car.
Very interesting. So, but with each step, really, you know, you're talking about individual and organizational learning, right? So you don't always assess from what the plan was. You assess from what the conditions are at that current step.
You don't do anything that looks like monitoring yourself as you walk across the parking lot to make sure you're still on the plan you laid out when you walked out the door. Everything you do is all about adjusting based on what you're learning as you go. That's right.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Ed, I know that you focus a great deal on the value of individual learning. And in fact, you state on your website that, and I'm going to share this with our listeners, quote, to iterate is to take one step, learn from it, just as you just mentioned in your analogy, and then take the next best step based on what you've learned. It's something that we all do naturally when working alone, but in teams, it's too easy for bureaucracy and confusion to take over, end quote. Can you start by sharing with our listeners, Ed, how the management teams in the highest performing organizations are run and what you can do to make your own management team better? And maybe can you just share a couple of pointers from your work? And I know, Ed, I just want to add that you have the 5 key practices of iterative management. Can you incorporate those and share those with our listeners as well?
Sure. So I call them the 5 key practices of iterative management. And the reason we want managers doing those is because, like you just said, we want management teams getting together on a regular basis, not to share status, not to sort of talk about how it's going, which is a lot of what goes on in what I call North American management, but actually to do what we've been talking about, which is look at the heading we're on, look at the likely result of that heading, and then compare that to where we want to go and make adjustments, right? That's what we want management doing. And we believe from research and experience that about 20% of companies or less run on, we call iterative management, with these 5 practices. So just real briefly, I'll tell you what they are without even using the names of them, because the names aren't that important. Actually, it's the behaviors that are important, right?
Yeah, sure.
The first is we want every manager to be clear with him or herself and peers and coworkers about what that person is intending to accomplish with their resources. So clear, short statements of intended output. The second is when management teams meet, they do so to look forward at what we call future variance, which is a short term for what's going to happen differently than we thought it would in the future, which is very different than what's happening differently than we thought it would now, right? That's the second one. The third is when they notice a variance like that, when they say, hey, look, the future is now different than we thought it was, they need to make a group decision about what to do about that. And if you've got a group of managers, probably the reason they're talking about that issue is because it affects more than one part of the organization that they collectively oversee. And so we want those group decisions to be made effectively. And then after they're made in full light of the information around the table, they're implemented fully, right? We don't want to sabotage a situation where we don't know if it failed because
we didn't do it right.
We want it to just happen properly. And then if we learn from it and it doesn't work, we just change it again, right?
Yeah.
So that's third. Fourth is, we'll talk more about this maybe later, but every manager is to run his or her direct team and any cross-functional teams. They run all the teams in support of higher level goals, right? So we don't have a siloing. We don't have a situation where we have peers fighting each other for my piece or your piece. Peers are working together on the higher level goal. And then finally, at the front line, we want management there helping the front of the organization to both optimize their output, but also to do a good job and better job feeding information up as to how it's really going, because that's where the organization gets its forward look, is from the people doing the work. And
right.
So if you get those five things going on, and you can sort of tell as I talk about them, what you end up with is something more like that walk to the car, where you've got these regular meetings and discussions between managers saying, you know, where is this course taking us and how should we change it to get back on track to where we're going? Do we have a surprise success? Do we have a problem? You know, what's coming and what should we do about it today? And, you know, you can go on my website, iteratenow.com. You can go there and see the names of the practices. But again, I don't even want to share them now, because I feel like you get into naming in this business and people start saying, well, I know what that is. That's sort of distracting. What you want to make sure is those practices are happening, and you can call them really whatever you want.
Interesting. So the idea with the five key practices of iterative management that you just explained, in part certainly, is to create organizational flexibility and agility, right? To use your analogy, it's to make adjustments with each step of the way. And I think that by following these five steps, you know, it certainly seems that this process of iterative management certainly helps create organizational agility. And so why does organizational agility even matter? How would you respond to that for our listeners? I mean, what's the value in organizational agility?
You know, this is systems work. And so back to that sort of walk the car, right? Imagine yourself walking across the parking lot, focused entirely on the extent to which you are still following the plan you laid out when you left the building, and also every single step you make, to what extent that matches what you were supposed to do when you planned it several steps ago, right? It would make no sense. You'd be walking, looking down and looking backwards. I mean, it's sort of obvious, right? That doesn't work. We have that going on in a lot of organizations today. They are looking at their feet as they walk, and successive levels of managers are looking down at the level below them to make sure they're doing their work. And so you lose the ability to look forward, and you lose the ability to make decisions now based on what you see forward. And by the way, if you do happen to look up and notice you're going in the wrong direction, it's not always entirely clear what to do about that, right? Imagine yourself looking down and backwards in the parking lot, and then you suddenly look up and realize you're heading the wrong way. Do I have to make a new plan? You know, it's like, it's not clear. So this agility, it's not, I feel like the term gets thrown around sort of in a motherhood and apple pie way, but it's really a very, you know, it's not just a good idea. It's like the alternative is just not good, right? The alternative is, you know, I've got blinders on and I don't know that I'm heading for a cliff until I get pretty close to it. And that's expensive on a number of different axes, you know, financially being only one of them. It's expensive for employee retention. It's expensive for achievement objectives. It's expensive for, you know, stakeholder and stockholder value. It's just a problem.
Interesting. You know, a lot of times when you think about a plan, right, like a strategy, sometimes there could be a pretty rigid approach, very transactional approach to meeting that direction, you know, that strategy. But I think what you're suggesting here is very important to have that flexibility and that agility and be actually transformational instead of transactional in how you, you know, you get to the end game, right? So sometimes taking it step by step and reevaluating and reassessing and just understanding that that's going to happen, you don't always hit your marks every step of the way. So it's important to have that flexibility and make these adjustments on the fly. Does that make sense?
It's accurate. I would even go a step further and say, you know, it's not just that it's okay to miss the marks as you go. It's more like we fully expect today's plan to change tomorrow. And so it's not only a please don't be afraid to bring us sort of quote unquote bad news if things are not what we expected. It's really more like a thank you and please hurry up as soon as you can and bring us news of difference. Because yeah. the sooner we hear of it, the sooner we can replan, and we're going to replan every 5 minutes forever, right? So it's sort of yeah. it's an acknowledgement of the reality we live in, as opposed to a sort of a fiction that we can plan, you know, in a good way, because we can't, you know, we don't know enough. We're changing things as we go.
Exactly. Well said. So Ed, we know that within organizations, and especially ERP organizational change, in my view and our experience, you know, silos can develop within an organization. How does iterative management help prevent and even tear down silos internally within organizational teams and cultures even?
It is a key piece of the iterate approach. And it's actually, it's one of the five key practices. It's the one that I call linked teams. I promise not to go through all the names, but this one is linked teams. And the way it works is this. So you've got, you know, let's take a specific example. So you've got, you know, you, me, and Jonathan, the three of us, and mm-hmm. we are peer managers, right? So let's say with a real simple organization, Jack develops the product, Jonathan produces the product, and Ed sells and markets the product, right? So we each have our goals around that. So we have development targets, and we have production targets, and we have sales targets. And in what I call the North American approach, our boss, who is the same for all of us, would say to each of us, maybe together, but probably in a one-on-one meeting, here are your targets, make sure you hit them. If you hit them, you have succeeded. If you don't hit them, you've failed. Please succeed. And if all three of you succeed, then I can stitch it together into the result that the organization needs, right?
Yeah.
That's sort of North American management. And it's very consistent, by the way, with North American mythology around kind of the cowboy, you know, that sort of individualistic, right? The boss will put it all together and make it work, right? What we actually know works better is a different approach where the boss says to all of us, probably together, could be one-on-one, probably together, hey, look, you know, look, Jack, look, Jonathan, look, Ed, you've got your individual targets. You will be held accountable to those targets. That's why you have them, because it lets us know what you're doing and it's a commitment you've made. You may have to adjust it, but we exist as a team to develop and produce and sell this product into the market. And if we don't do all of that well, it doesn't really matter if we did some of it well. So we're going to function in this team to the higher level goal, which means if you want to bring in an issue with one of your goals and you want to argue that, hey, I should get so-and-so's resources, you know, Jack wants Ed's resources because he thinks it's a better use of the resource, that's fine. That's welcome. But the argument is it's a better use of the shared resource for the higher level goal, because we, you know, we're going to fail the same way, whether we sell something we didn't develop or produce yeah. something we didn't sell, you know, like it's
right.
still a failure.
Exactly.
And, you know, it's such a simple thing in one level for a boss at any level to say, look, we're a team. This is the team charter. It's the same as the goals I owe my boss. And we all succeed or fail together. So please act like it. It's yeah. also so different, I think, in a lot of organizations that managers hesitate to say it. And it's almost a little too powerful, it feels like, but it's so important, because you can't get rid of the reptile brain that wants to, you know, make the person that is holding that brain successful. You can't get rid of that.
Yeah.
But you can
right.
sure redefine success, right? You can sure say, yeah. like, look, if your partner fails, you know, hey, Jack, you know, if Ed fails, you failed too. Well, you yeah. know, hey, Ed, if Jonathan fails, you fail too. Well, maybe I'm not like a super sort of friendly sort, you know, so I'm not going to get more friendly in this situation, but maybe I'm going to go sort of thrust help upon somebody and say, you need my help. I'm going to help you because I realize we need to get this done, right? That's the change, and it's a huge, important shift.
Interesting. So, Ed, in regards to your iterative management approach and methodology, you discuss how building a motivating workplace is pertinent for a healthy culture. What do you mean by that exactly? And how do you do that? Can you share some tips with our listeners, maybe some tactical and practical tips?
Yeah, you know, the thing about culture, my favorite definition of culture comes from Edgar Schein of Sloan, who we think mm-hmm. invented the term. And he basically said, I'll say it probably less elegantly than he did, but he basically said, culture is we, either us now or the us before us, had some problems. And we evolved some solutions to those problems through probably trial and error. And now, based on what those solutions were, we teach back and forth to each other unconsciously the way in which we think and feel and perceive these problems based on what worked before, right? So what that definition says is, you know, whoever you are, you're always teaching culture, right? You're always solving problems and doing things. And to the extent that people are able to see you doing it, they will pick that up and sort of turn that into the culture of the next generation or the next iteration, if you will, right? If you have a management team, for example, that exists in what I would say a high fiction situation, meaning, you know, we get together for the meetings, we all pretend it's going well, And then we run around like crazy behind the scenes in between meetings to try and catch up to the work we said was already okay. And that goes on in a lot of organizations. You know, you could say, well, that's a cultural pattern. It is. And people are showing each other to do that by doing it in front of each other. It's also not a particularly motivating or engaging place to work, right? It's high stress. It's probably lower output. It's not too enjoyable. It doesn't feel very authentic, right? There's a lot of reasons it's bad. And so it behooves the organization and the managers within it, both for their individual life quality and also for the organization's health, to not do stuff like that, to say, oh, I can see how we evolved this sort of set of behaviors, but I'm going to model something different because we can do better, right? And mm-hmm. and as soon as you model something different, you're modeling a different culture and you're working on that culture equation from Shine again. So yeah, I think it's very important. And I think that management, upper level, and especially upper level and also middle level management, have a really strong role to play because they're the ones running those meetings that display those behaviors. So they can really make a change pretty routinely.
You know, and one of the things about culture too, it does take strong leadership because often when you talk about culture, it's something that's pretty abstract. It's a bit intangible. It can be often hard to see and to recognize and to really understand what's going on with the culture. You know, so good points. So Ed, given that, in terms of organizational influences and understanding the lay of the land, how is it that if employees or students have the knowledge and if they are also motivated, how can the cultural setting possibly impact learner behavior and performance?
You were just talking about, you know, there's sort of a role for leadership in this, and there is. And I love what you said about, you know, culture is, it's sort of vague. And I feel like the vagueness of the idea of culture is hurting us, right? So culture, we can be a little more specific. Here's a way to do that. You're walking to your car. Like I said, you're taking every best next step you can. Where in that story is the culture? I think a lot of people would say it's the weather. You know, it's like, is it raining on you or not?
Yeah.
The problem with that, it sounds kind of good, but the problem with that is you have no control over the weather, right? So I would argue the culture is more like your habits. Like, are you swinging your arms? Are you smoking a cigarette? Like, these are things that act on you as habits, like the weather, but you also act on them through conscious choice. You can change a habit. We have tools for that. You know, we have ways to quit smoking, right? It's not easy, but we can do it. So I think as you sort of think about, you know, the role for organizational learning, if you turn that into a behavior and you say, you know, it turns out it's beneficial to us to learn as we go and to adjust. And if you can find ways to operationalize that into sort of visible behaviors by others, it doesn't have to be the CEO who changes the culture. It can be, you know, frontline employees or mid-level managers who just start to demonstrate something different. As long as it's demonstrated in a way that's visible and it's a behavior that helps, people will pick up on it and do it. You know, they might not thank you in the way that you'd like if you're the one demonstrating it. They might not even really notice you're doing it, but they will start to copy it because that's how humans work. And so, you know, there's a role for everyone in improving organizational learning and improving organizational and management culture just through paying attention to, hey, you know, what are we teaching back and forth to each other? And to what extent is it really working? And to what extent is it, like we were talking about before, you know, producing issues of engagement or output quality that we don't really want?
Yeah, you know, one of the things too is I'm a big believer in culture. I think that in terms of ERP organizational change, which is very much a technical project, it's a process project, business process reengineering, but it's certainly the human and people factor. You know, it is the organizational culture. It's, for me, the organizational culture is kind of that glue that holds everything together. And as I'd mentioned, organizational culture can be a bit abstract, you know, it can be a bit invisible. But I think that the more that you can try to do things, not only tactically and practically to improve that, and that may be in the form of different leadership sessions and just really making sure people understand culture and what to look for and how to improve it. But I also think that it's important, best you can, to try to measure that or at least take the temperature of the culture. And that's why we actually incorporate some different practical and tactical mechanisms as well. And I'm not sure if you're familiar with Dr. Dennison's the Dennison model for measuring organizational culture. So we like to incorporate that. You know, to your point, it's a very powerful part of any organizational improvement effort. And I think the more that you can take something that's very abstract and intangible and make it a little more concrete and visible, you know, I think that's always helpful. So
I'm a big advocate for, you know, making it, like you said, making it as visible as possible. And I'm a specialist in management cultures. I'm a little narrow in that sense, but it's not the weather. It's sort of, it's the operating system. I mean, it's the way you run. And if it feels vague, it's because you haven't figured out how to define it yet, but that doesn't mean it's not there. You know, it just, you haven't noticed it yet. And it is powerful.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Great point. So Ed, I can tell you from your work that you value research and principles. In fact, in our first question, you even mentioned a reference to research, but more important, effective and efficiently applying tools and techniques that work, I know is of value to you. And you state on your website, and again, just to share a couple of quotes with our listeners, we do research and use only field-tested models and programs that are easy to apply and provide maximum value for the investment, smart solutions with real impact. You then go on to say in your website, Ed, that, quote, we give you tools, not theories. Our longest interventions take months. The shortest take minutes. Either way, we leave you with the tools for immediate impact. You're the culture changer, end quote. You also said, just one more quote, Ed, on your website, you also noted that, quote, our solutions are based on extensive research and have been proven to be effective across a wide range of industries and organizational levels. Group Harmonix has solutions to your everyday workplace dilemmas. Our programs condense decades of research into practical, immediately applicable strategies. After each one, every person will know exactly what to do to decrease stress, increase output, and produce more sustainable and scalable results, end quote. Can you share and explain with our listeners, Ed, more about how your model is based on sound research and how that creates effective and efficient practical application to the workplace?
Sure. Yeah. Thank you. And I appreciate you reading off the groupharmonix.com website. That's some of the marketing stuff. But we're careful to say that we are research-based because we've been careful to be research-based. And we're actually, you know, not everyone knows this, but we, when I say we, like everyone in my space, we're all essentially pulling from the same body of research around group work. Anybody who does anything research-based in that space is going back to that well. And they should. It's good. It's complete. And honestly, it hasn't changed much in the last 40 years because the human brain hasn't changed much in the last 40 years. Yeah. So the question you want to ask about kind of anyone doing this kind of work in any space is how the research is being applied and whether it's being applied correctly and effectively. Yeah. And when you get to culture, and especially management culture where I'm functioning, and especially, you know, mid and higher level management, the application gets tricky. And that's because most of the body of work, almost all the body of work on group work and group effectiveness and group problem solving is built from university studies on group behavior, right? And in a university study on group behavior, you develop a hypothesis about how a group's going to behave. You pull together some experimental subjects off the street. You put them in a room. You give them a problem. And then you observe them and challenge them and test them and sort of test out your hypothesis. And that's a valid way to do research. The problem is that's a group of strangers. And management is never a group of strangers, right? So, you know, back to Jack, Jonathan, and Ed, the three managers, we're not people that got pulled in off the street to solve this problem today. We have a complex history together and a complex future together. We like each other or don't. We have helped each other or harmed each other or have perceived each other to have helped or harmed me in the past. We have expectations in the future about what I think you're going to do for me or do to me next week and the week after that. So it doesn't matter. We don't act like strangers because we're absolutely not strangers. And so those five key practices of iterative management are empirical first and then theoretical, meaning they're based on research-based observation and then theoretical research second, because there are no experiments simulating management. You can't really simulate a management team in any functional way in university setting. And so in our research, we're pulling in that standard body of work around group problem solving, but we're also pulling in from sociology, from psychology, from organizational design and behavior, even from neuroscience. And all of that is so that we can look at this question of, hey, when I put a group of people together that have this complicated relationship and I want them to produce some intelligent decision and some adjustments for the organization on a repeatable basis that keeps bringing it back on course, as we talked about, what do I need them doing? And that's question one. Now, question two is closely related, but is different, which is, once I know what I want them to be doing, how do I get them to do it? Right. And so we're looking almost at what you might call an organizational version of systems theory from psychology to figure out how to get an existing system moved in the direction we want. Because, you know, in the same way we're not starting with strangers, we're not starting from scratch. We have organizations full of people that are already doing things and they have patterns of behavior. And so that's why I can honestly say that there's really only a few people in the world, I think, that work with executive teams the way I do. It's not because they don't know the content. I mean, you know, you can go buy a copy of the Iterate book and that's the content. But there's really important subtlety in implementation and in how do we move the system onto the new patterns of behavior without disrupting it so much that it falls down and can't do the work. And there's a research basis for that as well as the content, and those kind of work together.
Interesting, Ed. That's well said. So if I may summarize your well said explanation in a sentence, allow me to do that and then correct me if I'm wrong. So essentially your approach is, you know, as you'd mentioned, you study several different fields, right? I mean, you listed five or six different fields and that you draw upon for your practice. And really you have theory and principle based on research. And, you know, obviously that's worth something, right? That helps you understand the general, I guess, behaviors of humans for one, right? And how they think and how they approach social interactions and that sort of thing. But then you combine that with the organizational context for practical application. So you draw on theory and principle based on research from these different fields. But at the same time, I think it's important to realize the organizational context in order to effectively apply those principles to practice.
Yeah, that's right. And you have to look at like the organizational context. You know, some of that is specific to the organization. Some of it is also not specific to the one organization but it is
exactly
to systems intervention as a thing, different from individual intervention, for example.
Yeah. Well, Ed, I really appreciate your answer there to that question because, you know, I think it's really important the way that you're approaching your trade. And I think that doesn't surprise me one bit where you said you are unique in the way that you apply research-based work to your practice. And frankly, that's one reason we're happy to have you on our show. We at Nestle & Associates take that same approach because there is value. There is a lot there that's founded in kind of truths and principles, you know, in terms of research, and it's highly applicable to organizational contexts. So you kind of touched on this a little bit, Ed, but can you explain your approach of what you emphasize and teach as, quote, culture view, quote, system view, and, quote, learning view? Can you elaborate on those a little bit more for our listeners?
Yeah, so I think you're referring to that little sort of Venn diagram we have on the groupharmonics.com homepage of those three things, right? So you've got the culture view, the system view, and the learning view. And I like to say we've kind of found a sweet spot between all three of them. You know, we've talked a lot, I think, Jack, in the last little while about the culture view, right? And sort of how the culture is this sort of set of assumptions, and it's this systemic set of habituated behaviors. And if you don't understand that, you can't change it. So that's the culture view. The system view, I think I've also talked a bit about here today, which is you have this idea that the organization is a system and that the fact that system intervention is different from a typical change program, you have to understand that, understand, you know, for example, when the organizational immune system throws up a defense, that's not the same as the intervention not working, right? So there's a whole sort of attention to the system view there. But the third one that we haven't talked much about yet, you and I right now, is this idea of a learner's view. And that is because, you know, at the same time when those other two things are going on, we are working with individuals, right? I can't move a system. I can only engage individuals inside the organizations in the actions that will move it. So there's this learning view, this question of how do I best transfer information and engage action? And so, for example, we know, and this won't surprise anybody who's in this space, but, you know, we get a lot more traction with experiential learning like simulations. We get a lot more traction with action learning like using the real work of the organization in real time in the new ways of working, as opposed to trying to fabricate a fake world, right? That kind of thing. Or certainly, you know, the lowest form of that would be me talking to slides full of bullets of text, right? We know that's a bad one. So we have to really be attentive to that issue of the learning view, because if we're not doing something that produces individual learning, individual action, then all the knowledge in the world about the culture and how to change the system is great, but all we're going to do is know what's wrong. We're not going to be able to implement a change if we can't work through the people that are there. And so that's where the learning view comes in.
Absolutely. Very, very important. You know, I think one of the things we do, Ed, on that note, I really appreciate what you're saying there. And I think a lot of times we tell our clients that what we do is really one part or 25%, as I'd mentioned earlier, computer science, you know, 25% business, but 50% people and learning. In other words, we're educators. And starting out and even conceptually explaining to an organization and helping them process what's required to kind of move that needle forward, right? And to make that progress is very much requires this learning view that you just described. I mean, that's a significant part of, I guess, successful change and progress. Have you by chance had heard of the Kirkpatrick model?
I like the Kirkpatrick model. I have. Yeah, that one. I like the Brinkerhoff model. Those two together, I think, work really well for looking at kind of paying attention
exactly.
to what you've made.
Yeah, same here. So when you talk learning view, you know, I that's the first thing I thought of because it really comes down to, you know, again, it's there's these principles in the ways in which as human beings we learn, right? And there's definitely ways to promote that learning and that behavior for learning. But then just as important is how do you transfer that, what you've learned and that knowledge, you know, to the workplace to make the workplace a better place, right? And to make that progress. So I'm going to include show notes for both of those models as well for our listeners' reference, but two great models to refer to. So lastly, Ed, fun conversation, great insight. We really appreciate it. But this is one of my favorite questions. You know, again, there's great research founded in principle that is reflective on and applied to practice is almost certain to improve organizational and personal growth and improvement. So if in 3 to 4 sentences, if you had to distill down your years of research, your education, your teaching, your practice, what advice would you offer up to organizational educators, you know, such as ERP organizational change practitioners or organizational leaders, as far as providing some key insight that would most benefit their practice?
You know, I think you'll have to check me on the 3 to 4 sentences, but I like the question. I think it's a good question.
Fair enough. Fair enough.
And, you know, I think that when I talk to anyone, I'm always talking about, so here's how you position with managers. For the audience you mentioned, I would say, you know, first, encourage managers to balance that idea of individual people goals with the idea of we succeed or fail together and to keep that balance, even if they fight you on it, because that's, it sounds contradictory at first and it sounds complex, but it's key. So that's the first one.
Yeah.
The second one is, you know, both for anyone and for managers in particular, pay attention to what's happening with the airtime in staff meetings. If for most of it, the boss is talking or the team is talking in the narrative about how it's going right now, that needs to change. And it needs to turn into something more like decisions about what we should do today about what's coming up. And then the third thing, if I haven't run out of space yet, the third one is start paying attention to the quality of data coming up from the bottom of the organization. Does it look like what we want to hear, or does it look like really useful forecast information? And if it's not the latter, work on that.
Well, how do you know? How do you know if it's what you think people want to hear or not?
You can tell by paying attention to whether the forecasts are correct or not, right? So if you're constantly getting a signal that everything's on track and constantly slipping, you know it's not a good forecast. If you're constantly getting a signal that everything's on track and it is on track, it's a good forecast. It's also telling if you are occasionally getting signals of slippage or not. If you never get a signal of slippage, that's not a great sign because things do slip.
So true. You know, you'd mentioned that one of the things to look for is whether or not the boss is doing all the talking, right? And I so agree with you. I think that is a bit of a bad sign. And it just reminds me of 3 or 4 different research articles, actually, that talk about qualities of leadership. And in those articles, there's one common theme, and that's empathy. And sometimes what empathy means, you don't do all the talking, right? That's listening. That's getting feedback from people. But it's also two-way dialogue. You know, I think two important attributes of a leader is just empathy and then creating an environment of that two-way dialogue and honest dialogue. So that's just something that popped up in my mind when you're talking about boss that's doing all the talking. I think that's always a bit of a flag.
Yeah, like I've had this conversation with executives where they've kind of asked me for some version of advice about who to hire. And I've said, I don't care who you hire. You'll figure out who has the skills you need. But if you meet somebody who tells you they know what the organization needs before they get here, I would be careful because that's lack of listening, right? We want people to come in and pay attention for a little while. You know, we want them to have the skills to figure out what it needs. But when they're coming with a canned approach, I'd worry about that.
Yeah, I so agree. I mean, wouldn't that be a major red flag? I would have a major concern about that. You know, that almost shows a maybe lack of experience, right? And lack of understanding that every culture and every organizational context is so different. So to come in with kind of preconceived solutions, I think to me would be a significant red flag and unfair to the organization.
it happens more often than I would have thought it does based on my experience. Yeah, it's something to watch out for.
Yeah. Well, hey, Ed, thank you greatly for your time today. This was a fun conversation, and I can tell you right now, we would love to have you back on. A couple of the questions and your responses deserve much more time, and so I think we would like to get you back on here sooner than later and drill down into some of these points a little bit more. But hey, thanks. It was a fun conversation. We appreciate your time. Thank you again, and be well.
Thank you, Jack. Thanks for having me, and always happy to come back if it works for you, if it's helpful. But thanks for having me and for the chance to chat. I enjoyed it as well.
Absolutely. You bet. Thank you.
Listeners, thank you for joining us on today's episode. We are incredibly excited and grateful to have friends, colleagues, and mentors join us on our podcast. We have an incredible lineup of guests, including ERP and organizational change speakers, authors, professors, researchers, pioneers in the field, practitioners, PE partners, business executives, ERP vendors, and organizational stakeholders. We invite you to leave us feedback and a review because we want to make this the most useful and insightful podcast you listen to. And we need your help to do so.
Thank you, listeners, for being with us again this week as we seek to, one, promote, connect, and foster relationships in the ERP organizational change community, two, contribute to the field of ERP organizational change, and three, bring research and practice closer together. Please join us again next week as we discuss the latest ERP organizational change research, practice, and stories. Our podcast will draw on knowledge from extensive research, collaborative learning, and practitioner expertise and experience.
From everyone here on the team, Jack, and myself, we wish you a great week, and we hope to see you again soon on another episode.
Hashtag the ERP Organizational Change Journal. Have a fantastic week.
Bye for now.